Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about an event that's significant in American labor history and also a significant event in the history of Chicago. It happened 120 years ago this week. It's the event that has come to be called the Haymarket Riot. 120 years ago this week, a bomb exploded at a labor rally in Chicago, and a police officer was killed. A number of others were injured. In response, the police drew their weapons and they fired on the assembled crowd. In all, 11 people died. This bombing happened during the middle of one of the biggest national labor strikes that people in this country had ever seen. It made headlines across the country and helped to turn sentiment, national sentiment, against the labor movement in this country and set it back quite a bit. This morning in this part of the show, we'll look back to these events. It took place in May of 1886 as we talk with historian James Green. He's authored a book on the subject. His book is entitled Death in the Haymarket. It has just recently been published, and you can certainly find it in a bookstore near you. Also, if you happen to be listening in the Chicago area this morning, he will be in Chicago and we'll give several talks about writing the book Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. A little bit later on in the program, we'll give you the information about those. And, of course, anybody who is interested in calling in this morning here and being involved in the conversation, you can certainly do that. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. The book, by the way, is published by Pantheon, and it's just recently come out. Let me tell you just a little bit more about James Green. He was born in Oak Park, Illinois. He was raised in Carpentersville. He went to Northwestern University, and he also went to Yale. That's where he got his PhD. He taught history at Brandeis until 1977, when he joined the faculty at University of Massachusetts Boston, where he is a professor of labor history. He also has served as research coordinator for the PBS documentary film series The Great Depression, and as president of the Labor and Working Class History Association. He is the author of 5 books on U.S. labor and social history, including the book Taking History to Heart, and also many articles, editorials, and reviews. And again, for people who are here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to participate in our conversation, 333-9455. That's the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Green, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Nice to be talking with you.
We appreciate it. The book, more than half of the book, is dedicated to looking at what was going on in the United States, particularly for workers, in the decades before May of 1886, to establish the kind of context for what we're talking about. So rather than going right to what happened on May 4th of 1886, let's talk a little bit about what conditions were like for working people in America, say, in the latter half of the 19th century.
Yes, well, the book is, the subtitle is Death in the Haymarket, A Story of Chicago. And in some ways, I think that what was happening in Chicago after the Civil War kind of epitomized what historians call the Second Industrial Revolution, the really great takeoff stage of American economic development that created huge corporations like the McCormick's Harvester Works in Chicago. And at the end of the Civil War, the book begins, by the way, with the return of Abraham Lincoln's body to Chicago on May 1st, 1865, when Chicago was poised really to be the wonder of the world and a very unified city, welcoming immigrants to come and work in its factories and mills. It seemed that all boats would rise, and that with the war over, people were very optimistic. Unfortunately, what happened in Chicago and all over the United States was the business cycle took a terrible plunge in 1873, and a depression lasted for nearly 5 years, and wages went down. There were protests in Chicago and other cities in 1877, and they were put down by the militia and the police with a great loss of life. Nearly 100 people died in Pittsburgh, around 30 in Chicago. And this really sort of changed the course of history in a way. Chicago became a different city. The United States became a country that for the first time was worried about class conflict, about violence, worried about how its immigrants would behave and whether they would really be loyal to their employers and the government. And so long before the trouble began in 1886, there were signs of trouble in the United States and in Chicago in particular. This was the period Mark Twain called the Gilded Age, when great fortunes were amassed and people who owned capital and banks operated with what could only be called a kind of blatant arrogance toward the public, toward their own employees. And I think working people and the middle class people really thought this was unacceptable and wanted to change America, put it on a different course than the way that in which it was heading.
Hmm. So there are reasons why this happened in Chicago and not someplace else, not New York, for example.
Yes, or another city. I mean, after the Haymarket riot occurred, and we'll talk about that later, there was a great deal of speculation and really agonizing in the Chicago press and among Chicago civic leaders about why this happened in their city. And the Chicago Tribune said, well, Philadelphia has a lot of immigrants, New York has a lot of immigrants, Milwaukee, you know, why Chicago? And they blamed it on the anarchists, on the revolutionary elements in the city. But really, you have to look back at the history of Chicago and its very troubled kind of evolution after the Civil War. And the fact that these huge communities of immigrants, of course, the Germans and a sort of forgotten group, the Bohemians, or what would be called the Czechs, really felt like they had been treated very harshly by the police, by the authorities, by their employers. And there were people in Chicago who were acting on those grievances, articulating those grievances, saying, you know, you have to organize, you have to fight back. And so that chemistry that was going, social chemistry that was going on in Chicago, is what I tried to depict in the story so that readers will understand how people got on the road to Haymarket.
Hmm. Well, was Chicago at this time particularly a hotbed of left-wing political activism?
Well, it had a very active German community of radicals, liberals, socialists, who were the first ones to protest in the 1870s during the Great Depression. They were the first people in America who said, if you don't give us work, give us bread. This is something that was way ahead of its time, really demanding, for example, the relief agency that had collected relief funds after the Great Chicago Fire, to turn these funds over to the unemployed and not only to the homeless and the refugees. And this, so from the very beginning of that depression, Chicago stood out as having a strong community of activists, of reformers, of radicals. And it's out of that context that the Chicago anarchist movement emerges in the 1880s. And it's really the strongest anarchist movement in the world. And interestingly enough, not college students, not intellectuals, not college professors, but immigrant working people.
It's interesting that, as you say, you start the book making reference to the funeral of Abraham Lincoln and the conditions in America at the end of the Civil War. It's interesting that people reacted to these political activists in Chicago, and particularly after these events, what came to be called the Haymarket Riot, reacted to them as if they were in rebellion against the United States, and drew these kinds of parallels between the war that they had just been through, mm-hmm. and this time, and these events that they seem to want to represent or think of almost in those same kinds of terms.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Civil War really has a tremendously powerful effect on politics all over the United States, well up into the 1880s and 90s. And this is particularly true in Chicago, of course, a city that sent an enormous number of troops to the Union Army, a city that, as Abraham Lincoln said, was as responsible as any place in the North for demanding that there be a war against the secession. So the Civil War hung like a cloud over the city. And when the Haymarket anarchists denounced the government, denounced the state, and were prepared to overthrow it and create what they thought would be a true democracy, not a democracy dominated by elites and by the police and the army, they were compared to the Southern rebels, you know, to the secessionists. And of course, one of them, Albert Parsons, had been a Confederate soldier from Texas, changed his political views drastically and supported Reconstruction. But anyway, it was easy for the authorities to see these Chicago anarchists as another group of rebels, because indeed they were revolutionaries. Interestingly, though, the Chicago anarchists and their supporters also claim the legacy of Lincoln and say their hero was John Brown, their hero was Patrick Henry, their heroes were people like Thomas Jefferson, who said the people should, in the face of a long train of abuses, people not only have the right but the duty to rebel. So they link themselves up with the American revolutionary tradition and in a sense with the legacy of Lincoln, who, after all, was responsible for the United States, the Union being in a war that led to an almost revolution of emancipated black people gaining their freedom. So there was a real contest over the meaning of the American revolutionary tradition, and both sides made their claim on it.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is James Green. He's professor of labor history at the University of Massachusetts at Boston, and is the author of a new book titled Death in the Haymarket. The subtitle is A Story of Chicago, the First Labor Movement, and the Bombing that Divided Gilded Age America. The book is just recently published. It is published by Pantheon Books and should be available in the bookstore if you want to read it. Questions also are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana listeners. Toll free 800-222-9455. What sort of connections were there, or were there many connections between the Chicago anarchists and their movement and the labor movement?
Right. Well, the labor movement at the time was a very diverse group of organizations and tendencies. There was a skilled trades group. There were the Knights of Labor, who were kind of a big tent organization that everybody could join, housewives, intellectuals, journalists. And then the anarchists had their own labor organization, and they were with revolutionary objectives in mind. They called it the International Working People's Association. It had it's almost like unions today who are trying to link up with workers abroad. You know, the people in Chicago in the 1880s were already thinking of the problems of capitalism as being global. So they were all in sort of contention, and yet the anarchists participated in the Knights of Labor. They were accepted there as a legitimate part of the debate going on about which way the labor movement should go. And then in March and April of 1886, all of these tendencies got caught up in a great enthusiasm for the eight-hour day. I have to say, a little bit like what we saw in the streets yesterday, where all kinds of different immigrant groups who probably haven't worked together before, and unions and church groups, all were sort of swept up in this protest. And that's what happened in the spring of 1886, culminating in, of course, the first May Day, the general strike for the eight-hour day. And then, I mean, these differences among the union people were not forgotten, but they were all swept up in this larger surge of protest.
Mm. That's here. I think we need to underline this to make sure that people hear this, because it goes to this issue of why it is that we should honor the contributions of organized labor low these many years in America, and what it is that they were interested in fighting for. This most basic thing, what this the strikes and what was going on there at the time, this in May of 1886, what they were about was an eight-hour workday.
Mm-hmm.
How much did what was the average workday, or how many hours in a week on average did people work at that time?
Mm-hmm. Well, it was a minimum of 10 hours a day. Most people worked on Saturday. Some people, for example, in the steel industries where the furnaces were going, had to report on Sunday. People went to work in the dark and came home in the dark, and this included teenagers, children. People felt like they were living to work, not working to live. They were also unable to raise their wages. They had no mechanism really to do that except the market. When the employer found labor scarce, he might pay higher wages. So on the one hand, they felt like they couldn't really affect the wage rate they were getting. So they said, well, if the employers would cut our wages, which they often did arbitrarily, we will cut their hours. And they also realized that although workers made all kinds of different wages, the one thing they all had in common was the length of the working day. So that became the sort of banner under which the labor movement united. They also had the theory that if hours were cut overall across the board, there would be more work for people, that people were being overworked as well. So those are the reasons that the first labor movement came together around the eight-hour day. And you know, I think we look back, people in the labor movement look back, historians look back as these people as the pioneers, and some of them gave their lives really for this cause. There were no rights. Workers had no rights in the United States in the Gilded Age. Certainly not the right to the eight-hour day, not the right to picket, not the right to strike, or even in some ways the right to freedom of assembly. That was even contested.
Before, a couple of days before the rally at the Haymarket that ended up now in these events, there were some earlier events in the week that seemed to set up, or at least that were what inspired people to call the anarchists to call for the rally, and that had to do with a strike that was going on at the McCormick harvesting machine plant earlier on, a couple of days before. In fact, I think it would have been tomorrow, I guess.
May 3rd. May 3rd. Confrontation at McCormick's. Yeah.
What happened there?
Well, there was this mammoth general strike for the 8-hour day, which began. Well, it culminated on May 1st, 1886, and that's why May Day is now, you know, became later on an international workers' holiday. Ironically begins with events in the United States, because of course until recently May Day hasn't been celebrated here. But it was a very peaceful series of demonstrations all across the country, even in Chicago where people were very tense, and even a kind of joyous springtime. You know, May is the beginning of spring in some people's minds. And then there was this the real cauldron of conflict was around the McCormick Reaper Works, and there was a lockout going on. People were working in the plant. People who are on strike could not get back into the plant. McCormick, the owner, was so desperate to keep his employees loyal that he gave the people who were strikebreakers the eight-hour day, but denied it to the people who were on strike. It was a very tense situation. The police were surrounding the plant, and there was a rally there of another group of workers, lumber workers, and some people from the McCormick strike group came, and they were listening to the rally, and they saw the strikebreakers leaving the plant. And they became enraged and went over and confronted them. These were very bare-knuckle, bruising confrontations that occurred in this time when strikebreakers came in to take other people's jobs. They were confronted and harassed, and there were fights breaking out. Chicago police intervened and started shooting, and at least two of the strikers, maybe more, died in that situation, in that confrontation. The anarchist leader, August Spies, who was there, rushed back to his office and published a furious denunciation of this in the Arbeiter Zeitung, which was a daily anarchist newspaper published in German that reached 20,000 readers, so it had a lot of influence, and called for a protest rally in the Haymarket Square the next night on May 4th. And I think the events at McCormick were really a turning point. If it hadn't been for that, there wouldn't have been a protest rally at Haymarket, and the events at Haymarket would not have occurred.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was this rally on the 4th. It was, I'm sure the people there would have said this was a peaceful assembly, people exercising their rights under the Constitution to assemble and to speak. And I guess the question is why things turned out the way that it did, why it was that the police felt it was necessary to break up the demonstration. The mayor of Chicago apparently had been there a little earlier in the demonstration. He didn't think it was any big deal. He was there, looked, and saw the people were there, and he just went home. Later, the police showed up, said to the people, basically, break it up and leave. Then someone tossed a bomb into the right in front of the police. A police officer was killed immediately by the explosion. Some other people were injured. The police started shooting, ended up, I think, shooting some of their own officers, shooting some of the people in the crowd. And so that essentially is what happened. Why does anybody know what the decision was? You know, who decided to send the police in and break up what was essentially an enormous or troublesome or violent demonstration?
Well, let me respond to that by talking about the mayor of Chicago for a moment. Mayor Carter Harrison is an extraordinary individual as a politician and a political leader. He was serving his fourth term as mayor of Chicago, and the way I describe him in the book is keeping a lid on a social volcano that kept threatening to blow up. And I think he was a kind of political genius, actually, to be able to preside over an almost ungovernable city. And part of the way he had done that was to keep control of the Chicago police and make sure that another of these bloody riots that occurred in 1877 didn't break out again. And in fact, for a while, the Chicago police were not willing to protect strikebreakers. They said, we'll preserve order if there's a riot, but we're not going to do Mr. McCormick's work. In fact, McCormick then went out and hired private police, the Pinkertons. So this situation was eventually resolved by the major employers in Chicago saying to Harrison, look, the police force has to do its job, which is to protect strikebreakers and protect our property. And so that's what happened. And they hired a police captain and made him chief inspector to do this job. His name was John Bonfield. And he was a very strong-willed, no-nonsense policeman who believed that you had to really be tough with crowds in order to discourage them. And so it was under his orders that the crowd was broken up at McCormick's, and he was the one who was in command then. And he was in command that night at Haymarket Square. And he said later on, he had to testify in court on this, he said he was convinced by his detectives that the speakers at the anarchist rally were using such violent language that they meant to start a riot and that they meant to encourage people to commit violent acts. And he stuck to that story. And so that was what he said. I mean, my own view is that he wanted to simply teach the anarchists a lesson that they couldn't come and riot. And after all, they were at a rally protesting police brutality. It was a direct attack verbally on the Chicago police. So maybe that's why he did it. Harrison said, mayor said to him, you know, it's a calm, it's peaceful. They're giving angry speeches, but no one is called for throwing any bombs or shooting anyone. Harrison left, and Captain Bonfield took it on himself to disperse the rally. And, you know, in retrospect, it was an unfortunate action because you have to think if the police hadn't been there doing that, for what reason is not entirely clear, maybe the bomb wouldn't have been thrown and maybe all this death could have been averted. It's tragedy in that way. Anyways.
Our guest this morning is James Green. He's professor of labor history at the University of Massachusetts at Boston. His book is Death in the Haymarket. It is published by Pantheon Books. I want to take a second here to mention, because there are people who are listening in Chicago, I'm sure, that our guests will be making several appearances in Chicago later this week. On Thursday, May 4th, he'll be speaking at Northwestern University, where he went to school, at 12:30 in Harris Hall. He'll be giving a lecture talking about the writing of the book. It is open to the public, so anyone who wants to attend can do that. Thursday night at 7:30, he'll be at Barbara's Bookstore at 1218 South Halstead. On Friday at the Bookstall University Club on East Monroe, and on Saturday at the Newberry Library on West Walton Street. Any of those, I'm sure, that people want to stop by, they could do that. And, of course, if you're interested in reading the book, you can head down to the bookstore. Questions are welcome, too. We have several people who are ready to go here. 333-9455, the Champaign-Urbana number, toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll start out with a caller near Chicago, Homewood, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, hello.
Yes.
This may be jumping a little ahead. I hope you don't mind. But I heard in my history class that after the Haymarket riot, the government decided to build Fort Sheridan. In other words, you know, put an army close by in case there were more large civil disobedience. Does that fit with your history?
Yes, actually, that's documented in the book. And William Edelman, the Chicago historian, has written about this. Marshall Field was really behind this, and other major employers. The nearest U.S. Army fort to Chicago was 1,000 miles away, and so the employers in Chicago, fearing another uprising such as the one in 1877, and then when the great upheaval occurs in 1886, they do use their influence, and it was enormous. These were people who had great power in the Republican Party to ask the Secretary of War to site a fort north of Chicago on land that they had purchased, and that did indeed become Fort Sheridan, and that's where the 14,000 U.S. cavalry troops come from during the Pullman boycott of 1894, when a history repeats itself in an even bloodier way in the Pullman.
Were there other forts built around other major U.S. cities for this kind of reason?
I don't think so. No, there were armories. This was a period when a lot of the great armories we still see, these granite structures all over the center of American industrial cities, were built, but this was the only U.S. Army fort, I think, that was built for these purposes.
Oh, okay. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you. We'll go over to a caller in Indiana. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello. This is another one of those programs that takes me back, David. I'm two questions, sort of dovetail. Do you have any information or research you did on how the hay market ride was written about in high school history books? I remember mine pretty well. And if I'm not mistaken, that the labor was the bad boys, but the Pinkertons got some sort of notoriety. And I was wondering if you could talk about the Pinkertons, how their interaction with the strikers may have contributed to certain things. And secondly, I presume that off and on, things go up and go down, that in high school history books, the Haymarket Square is getting certain pushes one way or the other. I wonder if you have any comment on that. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Well, first of all, on the textbook treatment of the event, I actually discussed this a bit in my epilogue. At first, the textbooks regarded it as an act of, well, they didn't use these words, but what today would be called terrorism caused by foreigners. And it was a sort of way of underlining this menace to society that certain immigrants seemed to present. It was, you know, renewed with the fear caused by Sacco and Vanzetti and the Rosenbergs. So up until the 1950s, that's the way the event was portrayed in textbooks, you know, a riot by Reds put down by the Chicago police. But in the 1960s, it became a little differently handled. It was considered labor trouble breaks out in Chicago, police are killed. But I think the nature of textbooks is not to explain these events very deeply. So I think it's still not treated quite adequately. But history has improved a great deal, and I think historians now recognize the complexity of what happened there. The Pinkertons, well, their presence in Chicago, of course, they were headquartered in Chicago. Alan Pinkerton had his office there, and they were very much part of the problem in Chicago, I think, because they had been hired by McCormick to protect his plant, and this caused a great outrage, particularly in the Irish neighborhoods around the McCormick Works, particularly in Bridgeport, because people who were of Irish descent in Boston remembered that it was the Pinkertons who had gone undercover and informed on the Molly Maguires, the Irish miners in eastern Pennsylvania, and actually many of them were hung and accused of a crime that was reported on by this Pinkerton informer. So they were really viewed as public enemy number one in the working class immigrant districts of Chicago, particularly among the Irish. So their presence on the scene was very provocative, and I think had something to do with the violence that breaks out at McCormick's.
That's
later
good.
Laws are put on the books in the 1890s to outlaw the use of private police, and as the Pinkertons were also used in the Homestead lockout, of course, with disastrous results.
Okay, let's go to another caller. This is someone here in Champaign County, where we are, line two. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I heard you say something yesterday. I'm glad you're getting a lot of interviews that I wanted to follow up on. But also something you just said now, the industrialists bought the land for the government. Is that what you implied?
Yeah, they did. It was land that they donated, that they had purchased up in what is now Fort Sheridan, and gave it to the government as property to build a fort. Remarkable, but true.
Yeah, makes me think that this was a purposeful attack, you know, to try to help roll back. Understand also that you were saying that the eight-hour day had been passed in Illinois, and that's sort of what was being celebrated, right? And so what actually happened afterwards? Did that... Is that true, for one?
The reason I begin my book in 1865 is partly to explain that Illinois was the first state in the Union to enact an eight-hour day in 1867. This is not well known, perhaps not even in Illinois, but something actually to be proud of. And the law was supposed to take effect. Governor Oglesby signed it. It was supposed to take effect on May 1st, 1867. It's amazing how often May 1st figures as a date in this story. And the employers of Chicago simply refused to obey it. They said, we're not allowing our employees to work for 8 hours. They have to continue. So they were defying the Illinois legislature and the governor, and the state government of Illinois did nothing about it. And as a result, there was a huge protest among Chicago workers. There were strikes. There was fighting with the police. And this was the first May Day demonstration, and the workers were defeated, and the law was simply allowed to lapse. So there was bad feeling about that that lasted for a long, long time. And one of the reasons that the workers decide to go on general strike on May 1st, 1886, is that they don't have any confidence that a law passed by the legislature would be enforced.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's true today, actually. The Staley workers, who you may know about in downstate Illinois, were locked out. And one of the things that was at stake was a 3 days on, 3 days off, 12-hour shift, which if you add that up and divide it over the week, which is more than an 8-hour, averages more than an 8-hour work, a 40-hour work week. It's already more than an 8-hour day, obviously. But it also ignores the calendar entirely. And the slogan about the labor movement bringing us the weekend, well, people that work 3 days on, 3 days off, don't really have a weekend that coincides with anybody else in their life. I don't know. It's irony on irony.
Yeah.
Thanks for your effort.
Yeah, thank you. Well, after 120 years of struggle for the 8-hour day, you know, I'm afraid that you'd have to say, and I'm sure most workers would agree with this, that the struggle may have to begin again, because so many people working overtime, working two jobs, so many split shifts, and so this accomplishment, which is finally, you know, reflected in Congress in 1938, which is when the 8-hour day is enacted after 50 years of struggle, is now being undermined in many ways.
Let me go back to pick up a point that the caller mentioned. No one knows who threw the bomb, but I'm sure that there were people who would be prepared to argue that this was an act that was done not by any of the demonstrators, not by anybody on the left, mm-hmm. but it was done in a deliberate attempt to mm-hmm. discredit the workers and the anarchists. And mm-hmm. and in fact, it did. It had that effect.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are at least three schools of thought about who threw the bomb. The scholar Paul Avrich, late scholar Paul Avrich, had researched this at great length, and he was pretty certain, although he couldn't prove it, that it was one of the anarchists. The anarchists had been making bombs. They had a sort of bomb, small little bomb factory. They were prepared for street warfare, and they felt like this was the only effective weapon they had against the militia. So there were a lot of bombs in Chicago in people's hands on May 4th. So, you know, I think, you know, and some people said, well, I knew, you know, my grandfather had a letter and he told his granddaughter that he was the bomber. So there's all this kind of folklore about, and most historians think probably one of the anarchists did it. On the other hand, there's a very large group of people, including the defense attorney, Henry Demarest Lloyd, the famous journalist, lots of labor union activists who believe it was Pinkerton. Albert Parsons himself at the trial said he thought this was a conspiracy, a provocative act to destroy the 8-hour movement. And partly that gains credibility because, in fact, that is what happened. The 8-hour day movement was killed. There's a third theory, however, which Governor Altgeld, John Peter Altgeld, governor of Illinois, propounded when he pardoned the three anarchists who were serving life imprisonment. He thought it was an act of revenge. He didn't know if it was an anarchist, and he said that really wasn't the point, that someone in Chicago, could have been a lot of people, were so outraged by the behavior of the Chicago police that it was an individual act of revenge against the police for what that person, unknown person, considered to be numerous acts of police brutality. I guess, you know, one way you could look at this is that all the violence that led up to Haymarket finally turned back on the police. And it was very, very tragic. You know, ultimately 7 officers died, 60 were wounded. There are many dimensions to this tragedy, and that's certainly one of them. And you have to look back at it and think it was an avoidable one.
And I guess we should mention before we find ourselves out of time that 8 people were charged with incitement to riot, leading to the death of the one police officer, the one who was killed right away by the bomb.
Officer Deegan.
A number of them were sentenced to death. One committed suicide in jail. 4, I believe, were executed, or was it?
Yes.
5. 4 were executed, the others were sentenced to mostly to long prison terms. Maybe you can just talk a little bit about the trial and about what happened to these men.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the most exciting pieces of writing this book, just from a writer's point of view, was writing about this trial, the anarchist trial in Chicago. It was the trial of the century and filled with enormous courtroom drama. The 8 anarchists were accused of conspiracy, of being accessories to murder, because they were alleged to have been part of a plot that led to the bombing. The evidence of this was extremely flimsy and circumstantial. I think that the men who were on the jury, the 12 men, really were ready to convict almost, no matter what the evidence was. And so they were convicted. In fact, one of them initially, Oscar Neeb, was not sentenced to death. The judge finally said, absolutely no evidence connecting this person directly to the bombing, so he's going to get life imprisonment. So it's almost as though the public said, the state said, this is such a horrendous crime. We don't know who committed it, but someone has to pay. And it turned out most of them were immigrants. And that, as a result of that and the way that the anarchists spoke in their trial, they even spoke from the gallows platform, they became renowned in the labor movement around the world as the Haymarket martyrs, the first pioneers, to die for the 8-hour day, to, as Eugene Debs said, to die for the cause of industrial freedom. At the time, Joseph Medill, the publisher of the Tribune, tried to persuade the governor and other businessmen in Chicago not to execute these men, to give them life imprisonment. No one really expected that they would get death sentences because none of them were actually perpetrators, but they did. He said, Medill said, if you execute these men, they will become martyrs, and they will be remembered much, much longer than they should be. And he was right.
Let us talk with some more people who are listening here. Perhaps also I should introduce again our guest in this hour of Focus, James Green. He's professor of labor history at the University of Massachusetts at Boston. He grew up outside Chicago and went to Northwestern University, and is author of this book, Death in the Haymarket, A Story of Chicago, the First Labor Movement, and the Bombing that Divided Gilded Age America. His book is published by Pantheon and is one of a number of books that he has written that have to do with labor history in the United States, labor and social history. We have some callers here. We'll go next to a nearby community, Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay. Back in the late 70s and through most of the 80s, I worked at this factory in Charleston, Illinois, Trimmobile. They built semi-trailers. When I first started there, they were owned by the Pullman Company out of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Also the union was the AIW, which was, I believe, Allied Industrial Workers. And at the time, I looked it up. They came down, I believe the AIW came down from the Wobblies, from the IWW.
They could be. For the listeners, the IWW was the Industrial Workers of the World, militant radical labor organization founded in Chicago, as many of these things were, in 1905, by people who were very much part of the memory group that were keeping the memory of the Haymarket anarchists alive. In fact, Lucy Parsons, Albert Parsons' wife, was at the founding meeting of the IWW. And I think there are, the IWW itself still exists and organizes.
I'm not sure.
But this could have been some, you know, Wobblies, they're called Wobblies.
Yeah.
They filtered through the labor movement. They were involved in building the CIO. So I wouldn't be surprised if they showed up out there where you were.
Yeah, but 99.9% of the union members, they didn't know their own union history. Even the guys who were, the guy who was president, I'd walk up to him, I said, do you know the history? Do you know where the AIW comes from? And he goes, no. I go, it comes from the IWW.
Mm-hmm.
I looked it up.
Yeah, well, in my day job as an educator, I mean, part of the work I do is labor education, working with trade unionists, as people do on the University of Illinois campus, to try to help, because people don't learn this in schools, and if you don't grow up in a union family and there isn't union folklore and folk music in the house anymore, these things are not known. And so part of our job as historians is to help people recover their own heritage, you know, labor heritage.
And, well, okay, and I would have to say that a majority of the workforce, they couldn't care less as long as they got a paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
I don't know. I mean, if in fact somebody says you got to do mandatory overtime, or you know, we're firing the foreman that you used to have, and we're bringing in this tough foreman, then maybe people find that they do care about more than a paycheck.
Yeah, that stuff happened.
Well, I appreciate the call.
Okay, thank you very much.
Let's talk with someone here in Chicago. This is line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
There was a statue to the policeman from the Haymarket riot at the corner of Ashland and Washington Boulevard that was removed in the 60s. Where is it today?
Yeah. Well, this is quite a story. This is part of the memory, history of the memory of Haymarket. In 1889, 2 years after the executions, the businessmen erected this police statue that stood in Haymarket Square, and eventually was removed out to the, I think it was Union Park. Is that right?
That's Union Park. Yes.
Yeah, West Side. And there it stood, and it was it would be defaced at times. It was even knocked down by
right.
Streetcar. It wasn't, working people in Chicago weren't particularly enamored of this statue because it brought back bad memories that they had with the police. And then it was restored to Haymarket Square in, I think, 1957 by the Haymarket Businessmen's Association.
Uh-huh.
And there it stood sort of neglected and run down until the 1960s when it became a target, actually, during the Days of Rage
right.
In Chicago in 1969, and the weather underground. People may not remember who they were, but they were activists of the Students for a Democratic Society who believed in bringing the war in Vietnam back to the
right.
streets, back to America. They blew up the statue twice. It was repaired. Mayor Daley had a round-the-clock guard put on it, costly, and finally, the city decided it would be better if it was moved out of Haymarket. And today, my understanding is that it's in the Chicago Police Training Academy
oh.
and can only be viewed by appointment, which indicates how controversial it has been all these years. And I think that certainly the police deserve their memorial. It's kind of unfortunate that there isn't one. But I think the problem was it was always a one-sided story. People felt like the other people who died in the Haymarket tragedy were not remembered. And now, of course, there's a new memorial in Haymarket Square that doesn't name either the police or the workers, but is a more general sort of reminder of the fragility of free speech and how easily we can lose that.
Pardon me. Where is Haymarket Square exactly?
Well, it's on Randolph, just
right.
Just west of Des Plaines. That's where this Randolph widens out in what was a very lively market, hay and vegetable market in
right.
the 18th century.
Okay, I know there's a statue of Governor Altgeld at Versey on Lakeshore.
Mm-hmm.
So there are statues around, but nobody pays attention to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you something. This new Haymarket statue, I don't know if you covered this, David, but on May Day there was an enormous demonstration just yesterday that converged on Haymarket Square, and I think partly because there is this new monument there now, and so it's taken on a life of its own.
Okay, it's a long time ago. Thank you.
All right, well, thank you. Let's go to Urbana. This is line number three. Hello.
Yeah, I think it's great that they had such trouble putting up the statue for the police and myself. The police have had such a anti-labor position over the years. It's incredible that they don't get more heat for it. But I heard you yesterday, too, on Democracy Now!, and I was wondering if you could elaborate on when you said that worldwide these convictions were pretty much considered an injustice. Could you elaborate on that? No, hang up. Thanks.
Sure. There was a long appeal process led by Henry Demarest Lloyd, various Chicago liberals and labor people, to try to appeal for clemency, that is, for the condemned men to be given life sentences rather than to be executed. But there was a growing sentiment in the labor and immigrant communities that they really were innocent and that they were being scapegoated. So maybe they couldn't keep them out of prison, but they could keep them off the gallows. And this clemency campaign had a European dimension to it. The Department of the Seine, the French deputies in Paris sent an appeal, all kinds of, to be honest, it was mostly socialists and labor people and radicals in Europe who cared about this. Because, of course, most of the defendants had come from Germany, and they were, in fact, European, so it became a kind of worldwide cause célèbre. And then when it was clear that the Illinois Supreme Court would not overrule the sentences, the U.S. Supreme Court would not overrule the sentences, the governor would not grant clemency, there was a kind of a surge of sentiment and concern about this. And so when the execution actually occurred on November 11th, 1887, the day the anarchists would call Black Friday, there was a very strong reaction. And I have to say, I kind of can do the geography of this, and it goes, you know, Havana, Barcelona, London, Paris. And so the memory of the Haymarket martyrs, as they're known, gets established there and becomes very important in the development of European labor movements and radical movements, particularly in Italy and Spain. And then, to make a long story short, these radicals in workers in Spain and Italy come to Latin America. They come to Mexico, they come to Argentina, they come to Uruguay and Cuba, and they bring the story of Haymarket with them. So for a long, long time, Primero de Mayo, the 1st of May in Mexico, the workers' holiday, was known as the Day of the Chicago Martyrs.
We'll try to get one more caller in here quickly. In Clinton, Indiana, line two. Hello.
Hello. What do you have on Pullman? I heard you mention the word.
What do I have? Well, I have an account of the Pullman lockout. This was the great industrialist George Pullman. There was trouble there in 1886 around the eight-hour day, and there was big trouble there in 1894 when Pullman cut the wages of his workers and had a speed-up. At the same time that his company was making a profit, and there was a great boycott of Pullman cars, and it led to a huge conflict and the intervention by these federal troops from Fort Sheridan into the city, and it was a terrible loss of life. More than 30 workers died, and this was the worst industrial violence Chicago had ever experienced.
We're almost to the point where we have to finish, and we've talked about the fact that this story got made headlines across the country, if not around the world. And here in the United States, certainly one of the things that it did was it fed anti-immigrant sentiment. It also fed anti-labor sentiment?
Yes, I think there were many losers in the Haymarket tragedy. Of course, the loss of life was appalling. And there were other losses as well, and I think immigrants became suspicious all of a sudden. There was a fear that in immigrant communities, people, violent people, anarchists, the terrorists of the day might be lurking. And so everyone suffered from this, and people who came here with no other desire other than to become Americans and work their way through the system became suspect. The labor movement was set back. The eight-hour movement was killed. The Knights of Labor, who were really led by very nonviolent, often Catholic people, were now called the Dynamite Knights. So the labor movement got painted with this brush as well. So there were many problems, and it took a number of years for the labor movement and its immigrant leadership to recover from this this tragedy.
We are going to have to stop. We're here at the end of the time. If you'd like to read the book, it's Death in the Haymarket by our guest, James Green. It's published by Pantheon. It's just out. He's professor of labor history at the University of Massachusetts at Boston.